Right. So, yeah, unfortunately, David, he called me late last week, and he's come down with a sinus infection, and so he asked me to take his place. And so I'm honored to be able to do so and to tell you about some rather surprising results from an analysis of our NMR data in not only some systems which we've studied, myself and Ben Lee Young, who's a postdoc at Los Alamos, but several other systems which we were able to track down in the literature. And so David Pines and York Smalian have really contributed a lot. So as you probably know, in metals, nuclei in metals don't have the same resonance frequency typically as the same nucleus would have in an isolated atom. In fact, there's a shift of maybe 1 or 2%, and this is the night shift, and it's really due to a coupling between the nuclear spin and the electron spin through a hyperfine coupling. So on the time scale of typical nuclear spin time scales, the electron spin is pretty much always in thermal equilibrium, and so you can show that the night shift, the shift of the resonance frequency, should be proportional to the spin susceptibility, the Pauli susceptibility of the electrons, times the hyperfine coupling. So a good test of this is to plot the night shift versus the bulk susceptibility measured independently, and you should get a straight line through the data, and the slope is a measure of this hyperfine coupling. So this is usually evidence for a single spin component in the problem. And for example, this is what's generally accepted in high TC materials. But in a lot of heavy fermion materials, this relationship breaks down. And so here's a pretty dramatic example of that. Cerium cobalt 85, at high temperatures, there's this fairly nice relationship between K and chi. But somewhere here around 50 Kelvin, this breaks down. So here's the same data plotted on versus temperature. So this is the night shift for three different sites in the cerium cobalt 85. And the solid line here is the bulk susceptibility. So you can see somewhere around 50 Kelvin, there's this dramatic breakdown where for one of the sites, the night shift is lower than the susceptibility, and for the other sites, it's above. Well, it turns out that this is actually a lot more ubiquitous than you might realize. Here are six examples from literature where similar anomalies have been observed. So cerium aluminum 3, cerium copper 2 silicon 2, uranium platinum 3, cerium arsenic, cerium phosphorus, uranium ruthenium 2 silicon 2, cerium tin 3 are some examples. One can kind of classify these into two categories, one where the slope, there's a change in slope, and one where there's actually a loop. And so the loop generally occurs when there's a maximum in the susceptibility. So historically, there's kind of been two explanations for this. A few years ago, Daniel Cox and collaborators tried to explain this anomaly in cerium tin 3 in terms of a positional dependent susceptibility. So that the idea was that the tin, which is inside of a condo screening cloud, sees a little bit different spin susceptibility than the bulk system would. And so that gives rise to this anomaly. Another explanation is around the same time, Kitaoka group in Japan measured some samples grown by Zach Fisk of cerium copper 2 silicon 2. And they argued that the anomaly in this system was due to the crystal field excitation. And so the idea, there's basically two different hyperfine couplings to different crystal field doublets of the cerium. And so then if you've got two different, effectively two different susceptibilities with different temperature dependencies, this can give you this anomaly. Well, in cerium cobalt 85, we initially thought that this crystal field scenario was reasonable, and we set the temperature dependence of the night shift to this picture. But then later on, there were some neutron scattering results that kind of showed that the crystal field scheme which we had used is not really appropriate. The crystal field parameters were very different. And so it looks like maybe this crystal field scheme wasn't appropriate for the same cobalamin 5. But on the other hand, this Kondo temperature is also much lower. And so we were kind of at a loss, especially considering that there's really only one component of one cerium site per unit cell that can contribute a significant part of the susceptibility. So then recently, there's this work from Satoru Nakatsuji, David Pines, and Zach Fisk, where they've analyzed this dilute cerium cobalamin 5 that's been diluted with lanthanum in terms of a two-component picture, where there are this is kind of a phenomenological model where they say the susceptibility and specific heat are composed of two components, this sort of Kondo insulator part and heavy fermion part. And the crucial element here then is this fraction F, which represents how much of one component versus the other is relevant. And this fraction F turns on below some temperature, which they call T star. And so the interesting thing here for us is that the temperature where it turns on is right around the temperature where we see this anomaly in the cerium cobalamin 5. And secondly, there are two different components of susceptibility. And that's exactly what we might need in order to explain this night shift anomaly. So in talking with David about this, we spoke with Jörg Schmeiling, who pointed out that if you have a system with two types of spins, you can construct several components of susceptibility from that. So say there's a conduction electron, a nucleus, which is connected to a background of conduction electrons and some local moment. And one can write the susceptibility in terms of these three components, where chi FF, for example, is the correlator between the S spin, the F spin with the F spin. Chi CF is the F spin and the conduction electron spin. And then, of course, for the chi CC would be conduction electron. But we can assume that this might be negligible compared to the large susceptibility from the F electron. So now if one postulates then that there's two hyperfine couplings, one between the nucleus and the conduction electrons through some contact interaction, which is A here, and then a transferred interaction to the F spin, then one has, in principle, ingredients to explain this night shift anomaly. So these two kinds of hyperfine couplings are perfect. I mean, this is a reasonable scenario. And in fact, this is the one of the main ideas of the hyperfine couplings and the cuprates. So so then if one goes through and calculates what the night shift should look like, then the night shift is going to be sensitive to these two components of susceptibility, this chi CF and chi FF. And whereas the susceptibility is going to be, it's going to have contributions for both. But the interesting thing here is if A and B are not the same, then the night shift can have a different temperature dependence than the bulk susceptibility. And so there's really two important assumptions here. One is that these two components of susceptibility have different temperature dependences, and that one of the components, chi CF, is negligible for temperatures larger than T star. So T star is a parameter so far. I mean, David would have an opinion about that. I'm not sure what to say about that right now. But I'll get to that. Okay. So how do we? What can we do then? Well, if we fit the high temperature part of the night shift. So this is night shift versus susceptibility again in cerium aluminum 3. The high temperature data is down here for low susceptibilities. We fit this and extract out this high temperature part, and then subtract and plot what the remainder is here versus temperature. One has this, so here's what this chi CF would look like for this material. And so below a T star is the temperature where the night shift anomaly is. But this physical significance of that, I'll get to later. But T star is where this turns on. And so here's for selenium 3, for cesium, cobalt, 5, for uranium, platinum 3. You can see for all these materials, there's a similar temperature dependence. And logarithmic. So if we, so this is the hyperfine KCF then would be the hyperfine coupling times the chi-CF. But the hyperfine coupling can be positive or negative. That's kind of an arbitrary parameter which we don't know. But if you were to normalize these things to a value at some specific temperature and plot this versus T over T star, then everything looks strikingly similar. It's just not something I had really expected. So here's the normalized quantity that's proportional to chi CF versus T over T star. And T star here really is the temperature where the night shift anomaly turns on. And everything seems to fall on this log plot here. So up until now, I haven't really talked about any specific models, just given the what I think is a fairly reasonable scenario for the hyperfine coupling. And we've analyzed this for something like maybe 15 or 16 different materials, both our own material and the 115s and ytterbium copper, cerium platinum silicon, which was measured by Ben Lee, and several other materials which we found in the literature. And for a majority of these cases, everything seems to fall on this line. Now, in the analysis that Nakatsuji, Pines, and Fisk did, they analyzed this this heavy fermion component, or chi-CF, in terms of this logarithmic behavior, and so times this F function. And so that's this solid line here, is this function. And in their picture, T star is this measure of the inter-site coupling, or kind of like RKKY, except David always points out that the RKKY is much more long range, and he believes that this is more of a short range interaction. So, yes?
You showed a plot of kappa, which is going to be radical between silicon. Kappa was proportional to chi, which is one of the few lines.
No, it's not.
It broke away.
Here, I'll show it. Sorry, I shouldn't have done it this way. There's a loop here.
Yes.
Yes. Right. So this is high temperature. As you come down here, everything temperature is higher than around 30 Kelvin or so.
Yes.
There's a peak in the susceptibility.
And then at 50 Kelvin, it turns around and comes back.
Yeah.
That to me is a linear plot, is it not? So how can you kind of see it from the anomaly there?
Well, would you say this is linear in this case? I mean, I guess it's a question of precision. If one should, in principle, measure this with greater precision of the night shift and see, really, do they really lie along this line or not? If these two hyperfine couplings A and B by chance are of very similar in value, then in principle you cannot see this night shift anomaly. And so very likely then the A, B parameters for this material are not so different. But on the other hand, for this material or one of these, the A and B parameters are very different. And so you can see this in a dramatic fashion.
Maybe this is something that's implicitly for metals.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, in your monster
compendium
body.
My what?
In the monster compendium plot that you just showed, if you happen to have a cerium 3 bismuth 4 platinum 3, which at low temperatures is not a metal.
Which one?
Cerium 3 bismuth 4.
Yes, yes. That's actually, that doesn't fall along the same plot. It's a kind of insulator.
Understood. So you should mention that.
Yes.
But then you're left with it has a cousin, cerium 10 3, which also doesn't. All that plot, which is not a
kind of
material. So
that's right.
That sort of forces a discussion. So
yes.
If cerium 343 doesn't belong on there, maybe it shouldn't be on the plot or maybe it should be mentioned. But then we're stuck with what's up the stream chemistry, which, you know, coincidentally, the 3/4
feed
is yellow and it can't be seen, but the can be seen. What do you think's up with that? Or is that just a spurious
emission? Well, that's a good point. And to be honest, I'm never really satisfied with why that one material doesn't seem to follow where the other ones do. David would...
we say is not following because it's insulator.
That's right.
Okay, good.
Right there. Yes?
In any of those plots, have the materials entered the fairly liquid regime? One of the questions I have is what's the form of fairly liquid? Do they peel away from this
Well,
that's the explanation of serial tin free, which is where it mixed later.
And if thorium, copper, aluminum is mixed fairly too, and look where that scatters all the way from the line.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this was actually the terbium copper aluminum is. I mean, we just scanned the data that was taken some years ago, and that's what we came up with. And I agree that's it. There's a lot of scatter there. Yes. Well, and cerium CMTN3 as well. Well, maybe then this turnover really is. I mean, the way David would says about this is that it does reach another temperature state where it's really truly just a Fermi liquid once again. And why CMTN3 that happens here, and for the other materials it maybe hasn't happened down to these low enough temperatures. I don't know the answer. But if you do look at, let's see. Well, I have to go back here. Let's see. So for this, the uranium platinum 3, it does almost look as if it's starting to saturate here at below maybe 3 or 4 Kelvin. But I mean, there's a lot of scan in the data. It's not so obvious. One of the things that I should point out, though, is it's hard to measure the spin susceptibility with a squid magnetometer below 1.5 Kelvin or so. And so a lot of the data just doesn't go to low enough temperatures. And then in other cases, cerium copolinium 5, for example, it goes superconducting. And so you can't track this down to low enough temperatures unless you go to very high fields, for example. And it certainly would be a fruitful thing to look for at low temperatures in a dill fridge to see if this should turn over at some point. So, let me show you this picture here. So this is here are the T stars for all these materials, and it ranges anywhere from 10 Kelvin to over 100 Kelvin. And actually, no, I don't have a picture of it. But if you plot T star versus something like the low temperature specific heat, there's no obvious correlation. So what David and Zach have argued is that T star really is this coupling between F moments, and what it looks like is this somehow this seems to be very common element to all of these materials, to all these condyle lattice systems, and it is not obvious if you look at the bulk susceptibility where T star would lie. So the arrows point to where the nitrate anomaly is in all these materials, so the point is one really needs to have night shift and susceptibility data to really pin this down. So just one quick note: one of the problems is that there's these two hyperfine couplings, and one doesn't have a measure of the second hyperfine coupling. So there's an undetermined parameter. And we can't necessarily analyze this other component, this chi FF, as a function of temperature without making some sort of assumption. So we don't really know what fraction is one or the other. But if one, for example, in serial M3, we made the assumption that at low temperatures, the entire system is that chi FF is basically zero, then we analyze the high temperature part, and it has this Curie-Weiss form where the Curie-Weiss temperature is, one would have expected a priori that maybe this is the T star. And as it turns out from our fits, it's around 10% of T star. So I don't know, this is kind of a simple-minded fit, and we know that the crystal field is important. So maybe if one includes crystal fields, one might make more sense of this. But in any case, the functional form seems to be kind of what we would have expected.
Could you give me a little help in
sure.
a physical meaning for F
of T? Well, yeah. The way that Nakatsuji, Pines, and Fisk discuss it is that there's a two-fluid mixture of helium-3, helium-4, and F describes what fraction of the system is in superfluid. I think it's a little bit more subtle than that, but if one thinks about it here, at high temperatures, there's not a lot of contribution from the conduction electrons. It's just chi FF, and as the chi CF turns on, the F electrons are getting are polarizing the conduction electrons, and there's not as much chi FF interaction. And so maybe that's one way of thinking about this without thinking of two components. But I don't know, for example, if it really makes sense to think of saying, well, a fraction of the time the F electron is acting as in a Kondo insulator or as a heavy fermion. I'm not sure how to think about that.
Didn't they in the original letter, which was now about a year old, didn't they do the dilution study?
Yes.
To determine
that's
F
right.
One minus F.
Yes.
In one limit, it was called a Kondo gas.
Yeah.
Which to me meant some sort of single impurity.
Yes, exactly.
With a well-defined Kondo. And in the other limit, it was called a Kondo liquid, which was the equivalent of the heavy fermions.
Yes.
But you're now using this for the highly concentrated intermetallics, like cerium aluminum 3.
Yes.
Your whole generic aluminum.
Yes. So, okay. So this
that was actually the point. That describes the work of the F electrons that are within this heavy fermion liquid. They're not behaving like isolated chromium impurities. So F is a function of temperature, and in this particular case of the 115, we found that the F does not even approach 1, as one would expect of a coherent fermion liquid, was something like 0.9.
That's right, yes.
And that was actually inferred from the concentration study.
Yes, that's correct, yeah.
There's been a vocabulary change.
Yes. Yes, you're right, there has been a vocabulary change.
You're referring to a condo insulator, which I think I have a fair idea of what it was meant.
No, yeah.
No,
yes, Kondo gas, Kondo liquid. Did I? I'm sorry. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so it's not a vocabulary.
Well, there is a vocabulary.
No, I'm trying to understand.
No, okay. Well, let me explain then. So, in the original picture, there was just kind of a phenomenological breakdown of into two components. What especially contribution from Georg Schmaling pointed out that you can actually have more than one component if you consider the conduction electron and the F electron. And so then one can postulate that chi CF would be like chi for the Kondo liquid components, and chi FF would be like the Kondo gas component, the single impurity.
So you don't mean to say Kondo
is. No, I'm sorry. I didn't know I had said that. Yeah. Yes, that's my fault.
It's been repeatedly through the bomb.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Yes. Okay. Well, the time is running out.
Yes, okay. Okay, so actually, I just wanted to quickly change gears a little bit, because John showed this a little while ago, this NMR and plutonium cobalt gallium 5. This is the superconducting state data where we measure T1 and night shift. I don't really want to focus too much on the superconducting state, but really point out something interesting about the normal state, which John also showed. So this is a plot of, again, of 1 over T1T versus temperature for several different superconductors. So the reason we plot 1 over T1T is that in conventional metal, this should be a constant. So for example, in the S-wave superconductors, aluminum and MgB2, this is a constant in the normal state. And then at TC, there's this Hubble-Sickert coherence peak, and then it goes activated at low temperatures. So this is all normalized to the value at TC, and this is plotted with temperature normalized by TC. Now, the interesting thing is for these D-wave superconductors, obviously it's not a Kohringer relationship. There's this strong...
I think it's a bit of an unfair comparison, because what you should plot is 1 over T1T times the uniform susceptibility of the night shift, which
Okay, but then the T1T is going to be sensitive to what's going on at pi pi.
If you divide by the measured susceptibility, does it still show the temperature
dependence? No, I haven't done it, but I would doubt that it would look like this. Because, yes, the susceptibility is very different in all these materials. But the point of this is, though, that the behavior at pi pi. So let me just point out here, in this other 115 material, serum rhodium 5, which is antiferromagnet at 4 Kelvin, 1 over T1T is really probing what's happening at pi pi to the antiferromagnet correlation length, which is diverging as you approach Snell temperature. And there is the sort of standard belief is in the cuprates that 1 over T1T is also probing the growth of of antiferromagnet correlations, since it is dominated by fluctuations at pi pi. And so 1 over T1T for all these materials is probing something in Q space at pi pi. And you're right, the behavior at Q equals zero, the night shift data, is very different for all these materials. But somehow, what's going on in pi pi is very similar for all these D-wave superconductors. Okay. Maybe we can talk about the derivation of T1T. It's interesting that if one postulates that then this is the measuring the divergence of the correlation length, then it seems that in all these D-wave superconductors there's a similar divergence of the antiferromagnet fluctuations in the normal state up to very large temperatures compared to TC. So that's really all I wanted to say.
Below TC shouldn't attract the energy gaps. And usually for BCS superconductor, there would be an exponential fall off of 1 over T1.
That's right.
And what's amazing to me is your unconventional superconductor seems to have a sharper fall off than the...
Yes, well, that's right. I mean, this is from the density of states in the D-wave superconductor versus in the S-wave superconductor. So this dotted line here is the BCS picture.
Okay, what is 1 over T1?
This is 1 over T1 versus temperature for the plutonium.
And it looks exponential, doesn't it?
This is T cubed here. This dotted line here is if you had a pure D-wave superconductor, which is D-wave. And there's this crossover, which we believe is from the radioactive damage caused by the plutonium. So. This one here? This is BCS. Yes. So that's the Hubble-Sickert coherence peak. Okay, so that's really all I have.
Okay, thank you. So, the talk is open for discussion. Do you already have a question?
Yeah, since you're on that table with all the key stuff, we talk about, I think you can make the key stuff, but you could use the same material, like all.
Yes. Well, so let's see. Okay, the differences here are the directions for the field. So if one looks at the Nyquist anomaly and for different orientations of the field, the Nyquist anomaly occurs at different temperatures. And the explanation that we have for this is that this T star is anisotropic. And if it's inner side coupling, it's some FF coupling, then it's reasonable to expect that it might be anisotropic.
Would you measure different bonds in your picture?
Yeah, it would be interesting to see how the anomaly varies as you change the field direction. But these are anisotropic. I mean, serum copper II single II is tetragonal, I think. Well, in NQR, it's zero field experiment. So you, well, NQR in a field is basically what we're doing. So if you had a nucleus that you're doing NQR in zero field, and you apply a field to that, you split the resonance line, and but it's also the splitting of the resonance line is going to be proportional to the field plus an extra bit, and the extra bit is the night shift, and so that's exactly what we're measuring. Okay.
You're going to have to give some sort of physical significance to the T star here.
Seems to go with. No. These experiments were all done in field. I mean, the night shift is a. To measure night shift, you have to apply in a field.
Yes, but you are not at the quantum critical point.
By coincidence, the data at the serum coupling 5 was at the quantum critical field, but this is at very high temperatures. I mean, this anomaly has at 50 Kelvin. So it's at 5 Tesla for the AB direction, for example. Yes. Okay.
You say it's determining what you're measuring because you have to do NMR in a big field.
Okay,
and
yeah.
It's not a zero field.
Okay.
Probe of the condo coherence, whatever you have.
On the other hand, I mean, this anomaly, we were very. I mean, when we first saw it in the serum coupling 5, I checked it at several different fields, and it's completely field independent down to 4 Kelvin. Yes, at down to 4 Kelvin. I mean, below that, below TC, below 2 Kelvin.
I have a question concerning the scaling. When that was presented in Aspen 1.5 years ago, there was some discussion whether that scaling obeys thermodynamics.
Yeah.
Has that
resolved? Not completely. I know that Jorg is...
You differentiate the sublimity with respect to temperature, specifically
yes.
with respect to field, and then you should get the same thing.
Yeah.
According to Maxwell, but from what these equations look,
right.
It's not obvious.
Right. So,
basically, here would say that it's all been resolved. They checked it all out thoroughly. And he present you support for saying that Maxwell's relations are satisfying. The only problem is that none of us have yet fully internalized this claim. But he does claim it's been all resolved, and that's the best thing. But by himself and David.
Well, one thing that David pointed out is that, I think it's a little bit more subtle than just saying two components. And so when you do some simple-minded calculations of free energy, it doesn't completely work out. And David says that it has to do with interactions that are present at high temperatures as well. I don't know. I don't know more details than that. But you're right, that's something that should be worked out.
Your
no, that was my objection.
Well, I've been watching this data evolve, and I think part of the problem here is it's been linked and collaborated with a very particular interpretation of what's going on in the heavy electron system. And I think that actually it can be looked at in its own right. You can separate this work and separate it out from the condo gas, from the liquid scenario that Nakazuchi et al. Has been putting forward. And you can, and I think it throws down a gauntlet to the theoretical community actually. I think that what you're seeing here is the confirmation of a scale which at which point the inter-site magnetic correlations start to turn on. Once they start to turn on, they form a liquid which has not yet formed the Fermi liquid. The sub-lowest temperature scale where I would imagine that this locking together of pi and k come together again, and in the intermediate region, you have this logarithmic growth of the susceptibility between the conduction electrons and the F electrons. I think it's extremely interesting. If we had more data looking at the crossover of the Fermi-liquid data, that would be interesting. I think on the other side, I think it throws down suggestion to the theoretical community that we really should be taking into account the nearest neighbor correlations that grow inside the Fermi-liquid, or whether these separate out to scale. And it's quite true what Catherine said. Ping Sun has some DMFT work in which he takes into account the nearest neighbor in the correlation and does see something that is reminiscent of his behavior.
Okay, since these nearest neighbor correlations will always be sensitive in these condo latitudes, what is then the meaning of the condo temperature, which is constantly appearing? You began to talk with a condo temperature for the 115 and for 3 Kelvin. What's the meaning of that then? Correlations are so important.
And is this the coherence temperature?
Because that's another temperature really come around.
It sounded like you were invoking coherence.
I would call it coherence.
So the color temperature is a single ion concept.
Yes. Okay. But you don't get
and of course we've invoked those words here repeatedly, but what this data suggests is that there is a low temperature regime where the true Fermi liquid establishes itself, and there is a T star at which point strong, which we call the valence bond correlations start to form in the fluid. And in between those two regions, it suggests, and it only suggests in the fluid, there is a very interesting regime which perhaps dominates the entire temperature range when you hit the quantum particle point. That's what it perhaps suggests.
Okay. And you can only get a quantum temperature through dilution.
Well, you keep saying you were condo temperature, and I've tried not to do that. As you say, in the relative limit of these systems, you can measure a single ion
condo temperature.
And one of the things that's so interesting in the Nakazuchi data is that the single ion condo temperature is way, way smaller than the apparent condo temperature they see in the dense system.
Right.
Yeah, but there's only one single ion condo temperature, and that can only be obtained through dilution and not through somehow massaging data in the condo lattice.
I don't disagree with that, John. I mean, if you do inelastic neutron scattering on the high energy scales, you're going to see a quasi-elastic feature, which is relatively Q-independent, which is a measure of the single ion dynamics. You can take that as a common temperature, even in a concentrated system. Then you can see additional features, which are more Q-dependent, which turn on as you go to the lowest temperature, presumably below this T-star scale.
Okay, take that system where you have the quasi-elastic, which is related to the condo temperature, do the dilution, and see if they are equal.
Well, if there's no chemical pressure, one presumes that that's the case, and I think that actually has been done.
Well, it's true sometimes, but other times it's not.
I would say to do it. That has been, again, another standard way of extracting the condo temperature from the neutron scattering. You can do it from specific heat for a condo line. There are various ways, and I don't know if they have really theoretical justification. Kathleen?
Yes, I have a nice question for you. For ytterbium volume to silicon 2, has it been checked that it doesn't fit the behavior up to the stress temperature?
Well, okay, so this is the data from Ishida. Here's night shift versus susceptibility. So you can judge for yourself whether this looks like a straight line through all the data. I mean, one might argue that there's maybe a change of slope here, corresponding to something here. No, it doesn't, because the susceptibility always is going up. There's no maximum, right? But That perhaps one might argue that, but one could also say that just by coincidence, these two hyperfine couplings are roughly equal, and then you can't actually, if for some reason they are equal, then you can't actually separate out the two components from night shift and susceptibility. One thing I would say, if I were to have done this without done this analysis without having the foresight of this Nakatsuji Pines and Fisk analysis, then I wouldn't have any reason a priori to postulate that T star is some measure of intersite coupling. I mean, I don't see any reason to think that. It's just some temperature where the second component seems to turn on, and so I don't know really if it's an intersite coupling or something more sophisticated.
How does the T star that you find compare with, say, the coherence temperature you might get from transport?
Yeah, that's a good point. I should have had a picture of this. One of the interesting things in the original paper from Nakatsuji, Fisk, and Pines is that they use this in serum cobalamin 5 and to predict what the resistivity would do, and there's a peak at the coherence temperature, and they're able to reproduce this pretty nicely. And so, roughly speaking, this T star is somehow related to the coherence temperature, at least in serum cobalamin 5. It's as far as looking through all these other materials, I don't know how well that tracks.
I think that's an interesting point. There's another way of getting at coherences or even T stars.
There's only two points, but it's true that the T star that you get for the two compounds where you did it actually has the same composition as the scale where below which the mass minimization seems to be.
Okay.
But it's only two points, so I think we should really try to get a few more points.
So that's serum cobalamin 5 and?
Yeah, and the road.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, on this happy note, let's thank you again. Let's.